All right. Yeah, no, it isn't all right. And it's not going to be all right until something major gets done about all this that's going on, all right? I just got to tell you, sisters and brothers, this is no time to be sitting back and relaxing, all right? If you just listen to the news for 5 minutes today, you know what the hell's going on. And you know, there's just one thing I'm going to ask people. From now on, I don't want to hear nobody come up and tell me. I don't even want to hear anybody talking about this. Start talking about Trump and talking about this and that and that and, you know, the president and what he's doing. This is a Nazi. He's a fascist and he's a Nazi. And let's just call it out for what it is. And then people should act appropriately. All right. So that's what we need to get started with. And yeah, I've been screaming in my car. I've been yelling all the way over here. It is so just infuriating to see what's happening here and to understand what it's going to mean for humanity if this is allowed to pass on, and what it's going to mean for humanity if people don't step up and stop this, and not just what is going on with the Dreamers and DACA. I'm going to begin by reading a statement from the website refusefascism.org, which is a valuable asset for everyone who's concerned about what's going on today. A short time ago, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Trump-Pence regime has decided to end DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Protests have begun and will continue throughout the country. Make no mistake about it, sisters and brothers, this is a straight-up fascist attack, and it needs to be defeated. Sansara Taylor of RefuseFascism.org says, "Today's decision by the Trump-Pence regime to end DACA, coming in the wake of the pardon of the racist Sheriff Arpaio, Trump's support for white supremacists in Charlottesville, and his threats of nuclear war against North Korea are a massive escalation of fascism in America. It's clear the whole Trump-Pence regime is illegitimate and they must go. November 4th, it begins. Many thousands will take to the streets day after day, night after night, growing to involve millions of people refusing to stop until our demand is met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go." Once again, that was from Sansara Taylor of RefuseFascism.org. The current announcement means that 800,000 Dreamers, undocumented youth brought to this country as children, will be deemed illegal and targeted for deportation. For many of them, this is the only country they have ever known. This is cruel, inhumane, and unacceptable. It is also just one piece of the whole Trump-Pence fascist agenda. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. As we have said since RefuseFascism.org first formed in response to the election of the Trump-Pence regime, this regime will keep launching repressive measures, eventually clamping down on all the resistance unless they are driven from power. All this makes what people do today in terms of organizing and spreading the word about November 4th more important than ever. On November 4th, many thousands will take to the streets day after day and night after night, growing eventually to millions and refusing to stop until the demand is met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. So, I'm going to be sharing two segments that deal with the terror that has already been unleashed on people from other countries.
All right, and at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Rachel Ida Buff, a professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we're going to be talking about the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. All right, so that's going to be at the back end of the show. And opening the show up, I'm going to be talking with someone I've wanted to get back to talking to for quite some time now. And her name is Margaret Regan, and I first interviewed Margaret when her book, Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire, came out. And it was a very powerful book, and Margaret really has some deep insight in terms of what's happening with immigrants across the country today and around the world. And right now, she's been writing about the roundups and deportations of immigrants and the impact that Trump's rule changes are having on people and society and are threatening to have. And like I said, Margaret's a longtime journalist in Tucson, Arizona, and the author of Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Michael.
Yeah. We'll have to make this a regular thing, though.
Yeah,
that'll be good. Well, let's jump into it, because I don't want to waste any time. We have a hell of a lot to talk about. One of the things I wanted to start off with is one of the first moves that's been taken by Trump is setting down his program. This fascistic program was opening up on immigrants full scale. And while he's not the first to hammer down on them, he is taking it to a whole new level. and it's been drastically expanded and heightened. Give people an idea of what this actually means for immigrants today.
Yeah, well, certainly under Obama, you know, we had lots of deportations, something like 2.5 million over the 8 years. But during his administration, especially in the second term, he was refining it and refining it to the point that the real goal was to look for criminals, people who had committed crimes, and those were considered priorities for enforcement and deportation. Well, under Trump, under these new memos issued around the middle of February, up to 8 million or maybe even all 11 million of the undocumented immigrants here are redefined as criminals. And he's expanded the ways that we can arrest those criminals. Just recently in Los Angeles, you all saw that, you know, there was that big raid early in February, not too long after Trump really got into office. And ICE acknowledged that in the past, they would go out, they would have a warrant, say, for a particular undocumented immigrant they were looking for, and they weren't really supposed to arrest other people in the house who might have been undocumented. Of course, that did happen sometimes. But now they're saying, go right ahead. They have their enforcement priorities, but if somebody else is there, we'll take them too. So this really expands the power of ICE to really do mass raids. And it's funny because the administration has said several times these are not mass raids and people should stop having a sense of panic. But in their own statements and in their own actions, they have certainly ignited a sense of panic in the immigrant community. I did a story about a woman from Phoenix who got a lot of attention around the country because it almost seemed like she was a harbinger of what was to come. A woman in her 30s named Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes. She had been a cleaning lady at a golf and splash park outside of Phoenix some years ago. And like so many undocumented immigrants, she needed to get a fake Social Security number in order to work. What Arizona has done is convert that. What used to be a misdemeanor, it's not that big a deal to make up a Social Security number, you know, not a really major crime. Arizona made it a felony about 10 years ago, specifically to go after undocumented immigrants. That was the stated purpose of the bill. So this woman gets caught as a result of one of those Sheriff Arpaio raids that became so infamous in Arizona. He did a raid of the amusement park. Her name was found in the documents. She was arrested and charged with a felony, and she actually served time in jail. But then after that, the government went fairly easy on her. She's a mother of two American citizens. They were young kids at the time. And as long as she kept reporting to ICE once a year at the appointed time, they basically just let her alone. Of course, she wasn't able to work. But just days, really, weeks, about 2 weeks after Trump's inauguration, she went in for her usual appointment, which usually was a small matter, and she was detained, and by the next morning, she was back in Mexico. They deported her very quickly, and ICE issued a statement saying, well, we are going after these serious criminals like this woman, because we have made her into a serious criminal by delivering a felony for using that fake Social Security number. So this is the kind of person that in the previous administration, we were allowing some leeway for people who are obviously not criminals, hardworking, peaceful family, you know, and this is the mother of two kids, two Americans. And now we are going to go after those people and afterwards, after we arrest them, and tell the world that these are dangerous criminals and that we have rid America of one more serious criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's extremely important. And I was thinking about that, too, and I want to talk about that a little bit later, too, because the other, or maybe we could do it now and then we'll just segue back into the other stuff. But one of the things that was really important about this case, too, was that it set an example for the kind of response that was needed, even though, you know, people were not able to prevent her from being taken by the system. They did actually stand there and they did some pretty heroic and inspiring things, the people that came down there to stop that, right?
Yeah, they absolutely did. That's an amazing group up in Phoenix. They're called Puente. They have been well organized for a long time because of the long reign of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. By the way, he was ousted in the election in November, finally. but he was the sheriff of Maricopa County for years and years, and he loved these very showy, telegenic mass raids of people, and he would always alert the press, and they'd get all these shots of people being being hauled in. So this group has been working and filing suit against Arpaio for a long time. And they're very savvy, and they knew that there was a chance that Guadalupe would be detained, that an example might be made of her. So they accompanied her to her appointment in large numbers. And when she did not come back out of that building as expected in the expected time, they organized a very big rally and protest. And some of them, you know, attached themselves. When she was brought outside in order to be deported, they attached themselves to the vehicle. And they got a lot of attention. They got a lot of people coming out. And that's, you know, really interesting that we're seeing increasing resistance to what's going on. And they got a lot of, not that they were successful in the end, because Guadalupe was directly deported the next day, but they got a lot of attention to this case. And she actually gave a press conference when she got down into Mexico, and that story went around the world worldwide that, okay, this is the first high-profile arrest that we all know about under Trump, and we can see how pitiful the case really was, you know, who the person was that we were deporting. So, yeah, we are seeing this. We are seeing resistance. You know, this has been going on for some years, but I think people are so disturbed and so frightened right now that we're going to be seeing a lot more of that.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Margaret Regan. Margaret's a writer who concentrates on what's been happening with the roundups and deportations of immigrants and the impact that Trump's rule changes are having and are threatening to have. And Margaret's a longtime journalist in Tucson, Arizona, and she's the author of Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. Now, tell me this. You know, one of the things that I was really kind of wrestling with, you know, it seems that like now there seems to be two things going on. And I don't know how much, you know, this one is actually happening, but the expansion of detention centers, which are really brutal places. But also the thing that really seems to be big in the program right now is the fact that there's to hell with due process for immigrants. You know, to hell with any rights, get them out, you know, pick them up. And they're constantly talking about building up the force to go out into the, you know, communities and to do these kinds of raids and the, basically even talking about wholesale deportations of people with no due process. This is an extremely important and serious development.
I think it is. I think it's unconstitutional. I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, in those memos that came out in February, well, first of all, they want to enlist, you know, local police, so that every police officer is basically also an immigration agent, okay? And then the new powers given to immigration agents are that an officer could pick up somebody on the theory that what a person might have done might be a crime that could be charged. We're talking about picking up somebody without charges, without an arrest, without a conviction, and being able to send that person into deportation immediately. We've always had this policy, or for a long time we've had a policy, anywhere 100 miles of the border, a Border Patrol agent, if they found somebody who'd been in the United States for less than 2 weeks, they could just send them back over the fence, back over the border, without any kind of hearing. Now that applies to the entire United States. And it's anybody who can prove they've been here more than 2 years can be deported immediately without any judicial process at all. So I think it's the makings of a police state. You know, that's a pretty inflammatory term to use. But if you give those kinds of powers, and I wrote about this recently, I mean, you're, you know, delegating the cop on the beat to be cop, judge, jury, and enforcement, you know, the deporter, that all those things can happen without any kind of judicial oversight. So I would think that libertarians who might like some of the policies of the right and of the Republicans would be more than a little alarmed about this increasing power of the state and of all the various levels of enforcement officers. You know, Trump wants to increase the Border Patrol by 5,000. He wants to increase, or no, I think it's the other way around, 11,000 new Border Patrol and 5,000 new ICE agents. So we're going to have more and more law officers out and about trying to stop people and catch people all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really struck me, too, is that Trump's made it clear that right now there is no category or group of people that will be exempt from deportation. What will that mean, do you think?
Well, I think it will mean that we'll be seeing more people like Guadalupe being arrested. we've been hearing some pretty dreadful cases in the national news. I mean, I think the press is really trying to do a good job on this and finding these really egregious cases. There's the young woman down in Mississippi who, I mean, her only issue was that she had allowed her DACA status. That's the waiver that young people who've been brought in as children and committed no crimes, you know, Obama gave them this two-year waiver where they're free from the fear of deportation. She had not renewed her thing in November because she didn't have enough money. It's quite expensive. It costs almost $500 to renew. She hadn't renewed, but she had already been approved twice for DACA, and she spoke at a press conference about the deportation of her father and brother. Within minutes after that press conference, she was in a car. ICE had tailed her, stopped the car, and arrested her, and said that she wasn't eligible for any deportation hearings. Latest information I could find on her was that 2 days ago, her lawyer was still trying to do something about it. I don't know whether she's been deported or not. But, you know, targeting people like that, her lawyer says in his case that this is an abrogation of her right to free speech. You know, that's a constitutional protection that we all have. Anybody in this country, you have a right to speak freely. And it certainly appeared that she was being punished for speaking out against deportation and against the ICE actions. We have another woman in Texas who was picked up. She had a boyfriend that beat her up all the time. She was getting an order of protection. Evidently true to his promise, he called ICE and told her that she would be at this hearing. There really doesn't seem to be any other way that they would know her. The judge gives her the order of protection from the abusive boyfriend, walks out of the courthouse, and ICE is waiting to arrest her and deport her. So really egregious things like this are happening. You know, in both those cases I just mentioned, these are not people who are a danger to America at all. And yet, if you read through Trump's memos, obviously he hasn't written them. They're all written by lawyers trying to legalize this new police state that we're moving into. They never use the word immigrant. They always call them criminal aliens. So in their view, every single person who is here undocumented is a criminal.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about, just so people are clear on this, we're talking about 11 million people potentially facing deportation. As I said, Trump's saying, nope. Nothing's going to stop this. You know, and there are whole parts of the world where these deportations, we're sending people to all these parts of the world where actually this could amount to, this could give rise to, well, it could have, and it does have, genocidal implications. It seems to me that's something that really, that was one of the first things that struck my mind because, you know, people oftentimes leave places because they can't live in the countries that they're living in and they can't go back to it. And what do you think about this in terms of this possibility of genocidal implications?
Because yeah, well, I mean, it certainly comes to mind with all these women fleeing here from Central America. I mean, these are women in real danger. I interviewed one who was in one of those family detention centers in Texas. Very typical story. She was a young woman in her 20s with a little girl, age 6. And she was in a town in Honduras, was heavily drug-centered, drug trafficking, had a major highway through it. And what happens is they try to coerce people into working with them, and they wanted her to do this job of going around to stores and trying to get bribes from people and so forth. You know, they exact tribute from people to be free of cartel influence. And when they do this, and you hear these stories again and again and again, they try to enlist people in their workforce. And if you refuse, you can be killed. So she fled with her little girl. She told me she presented herself for asylum at the border in Texas. She didn't want to do anything unlawful. She didn't cross the border, you know, surreptitiously. She addressed herself to the authorities. And she was slapped into family detention for 9 months. She eventually got out. But what Trump is all adamant about is that we don't want to let anybody out of those detention centers while they're awaiting asylum. And I don't know if you saw this week the costs of all this new enforcement, what we're going to give up to build that border wall, to build, he wants many, many new detention centers, most of which will be for-profit prisons. So we have a lot of people. In many ways, it's just a big financial boondoggle, right? Their idea is we're going to spend billions on the border wall. We've got to get the money from somewhere. So they're proposing cutting back the budget for the Coast Guard, which protects our coasts against any kind of invasion, protects our coasts against terrorists, which is always the big the boogeyman that Trump's always talking about at the southwest border. But we have, you know, really, the Coast Guard has a very good reputation for doing a good job. They do a lot of drug busts on the high seas also. So instead of, you know, dealing with real threats, he's going to take a couple billion away from the Coast Guard and redeploy to the southwest border to fight against these women flowing in from Central America who are in fear of their lives. I mean, it's really, it's monstrous when you think about it. He also wants to cut back on TSA, Transportation Security Administration, guard the airports that does border security, you know, entrance security in the airports. And the other one they want to cut back is FEMA, you know, which protects American citizens against natural disasters by having greater preparation. So these are real needs that American citizens have, and he intends to sacrifice those to build this wall on the border. The New York Times said, it's like Trump has this imaginary, we have an imaginary invasion going on in the southwest border, and we have to redirect all our resources to that thing that really isn't even a true thing.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Margaret Regan. Margaret's a writer who concentrates on what's been happening with the roundups and deportations of immigrants and the impact that Trump's rule changes are having and are threatening to have. And Margaret's a longtime journalist in Tucson, Arizona, and she's the author of Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. Now, Margaret, tell me this. You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is in relation to these sanctuary cities, because it seems like that's a pretty important focus of what Trump is doing, but it's also a pretty important focus for what people should be doing in terms of paying attention to that and standing up against Trump's threatened attacks on these sanctuary cities. Well, let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm interested to see what the legality of all this is in terms of Trump threatening to pull back any federal funds that these cities are entitled to. I can't imagine that that will go unchallenged in the courts. Just to be clear, you know, these cities that declare sanctuary, they're saying basically that we're not going to use our cops to hunt down immigrants because we think that's dangerous for the community. We had a case in Tucson just the other night. Border Patrol had arrested an immigrant in the desert. There was some kind of a scuffle, undescribed by the Border Patrol, and they took the guy to the hospital. And somehow he walked away from the hospital. Apparently the guard wasn't paying attention. This was on Friday night. So they call up Tucson Police Department. We have, you know, a dangerous criminal at large roaming the streets of Tucson. So the police said, okay, they deployed about 20 people for 2 hours looking for this guy. Border Patrol seemed to have no idea where he was. And after 2 hours, it's Friday night, the police calls are piling up, you know, all the usual stuff, drunk drivers and whatever you're going to have on a busy Friday night in a big city. And they said, okay, well, we're done. You know, we spent 2 hours on this and we're pulling back. The Border Patrol went nuts. You know, there's this head of the union who's always very vocal and made these really inflammatory comments about, you know, this was a political decision by the Tucson Police Department that they're, what if the guy had a gun? What if he had been shooting down people? He didn't have a gun. Nobody saw him in the neighborhood. But what they're saying is you have to drop all your other police work to help us get this immigrant who, as far as we all know, all he did was cross the border and walk through the desert. So I think that's really important. That's what, you know, Tucson has not used the words a sanctuary city. I think it's probably a political move just to say, no, we're not a sanctuary city. But on the other hand, they have instructed their police officers not to participate in these things as much as is possible. So I don't know what will happen, you know, with these threats of pulling money out of cities all across America, because, as you know, the cities are always hurting. They always need that money in their budgets. We have a very active religious community in Tucson. I don't know if you know, Tucson was the origin, the birthplace of the sanctuary movement in the 1980s when churches in Tucson gave respite, refuge to people fleeing our wars in Central America. We cannot forget that we ourselves destabilized Central America, and we're still seeing those results all these years later. But so Tucson, you know, gave sanctuary in churches to those refugees coming over. And there were arrests and there were trials. So we have that history of resistance. And so many, many churches in Tucson have declared that they are going to do radical welcome for immigrants, whatever that might entail. They said that, you know, actually housing somebody in a church is kind of a last-ditch option. And I saw, I think it's in Los Angeles, some faith groups are having members of their congregation agree to house a fleeing immigrant in their own homes, because they actually have more protections against a warrant than churches do. But that could be, if you did that, if you house somebody in your home, you could ultimately be charged with a felony harboring an undocumented immigrant. That's a serious crime that can carry 12 years in jail. So that's pretty serious business, but it seems like people are stepping up to fight against it. It really just remains to be seen how it's all going to play out.
Yeah, I think it's really important that people do step up and fight this, you know, because it has to be. The attacks on these have to be actually resisted. That protection, to me, I think it needs to be defended and extended. But, you know, I wanted to ask you this. What do you think would happen if they did just full-scale do away with these sanctuary cities?
I mean, if the cities gave them up, or if the federal government?
If the federal government forced the cities to declare that they were no longer sanctuary cities.
Well, I suspect you might still have a lot of police departments just going about their way, doing what they do already, and not, you know, go chasing after immigrants because they're too busy doing other stuff. I think you might have, like, sort of sub rosa stuff going on. I can't really figure. I mean, it's so weird the way, in general, people on the right of the United States hate big government. But what we are seeing here is the biggest buildup of big government ever, in terms of being able to control local cities, you know, and creating these new laws that put these cities in violation of the law. What would happen? I mean, I guess you're going to, you know, if people knuckle down, if the cities knuckle down, then we're going to have, you know, those mass deportations that we're so fearful of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And those things that need to be stopped before they begin. Let's talk about this. You know, you've done a lot of work around the border and just what's going on there. And now with this whole thing about building the wall and everything else, I wanted to ask you this, that, you know, there's this whole militarization of the border, and there's a huge fascistic army that's being built up to prepare for massive deportations all around the country, but particularly in the border, this whole area of sort of, let's talk about, you know, what's going on at the border and, as far as you can see, and the whole militarization of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been dealing with that in Arizona for years and years. I mean, the border walls first started going up way back in the Clinton administration. And Arizona, of the four border states, Arizona is the one with the most walls. And, you know, I often give talks and I have pictures of our walls. You know, this is around the country. And I say to people, see, we have very big walls across the border right now. You know, in Arizona, we have more than 300 miles of border walls. And, you know, so many people have said, from Janet Napolitano on down, you know, show me a border wall that's 40 feet high and I'll show you a 50-foot ladder. These are not people who are deterred easily. They've come from a really long way, really far away, and they find ways to get around them. We have all kinds of legal issues out here. Part of Arizona, there's an Indian reservation that has 75 miles of border. You know, they always say the border crossed them because their traditional lands extended into what we think of as Mexico in the U.S., but to them it's the Tohono-O'odham Nation. They're refusing to build a border wall. So then what happens? Is Trump going to take them to court? Is Trump going to change the laws about Indian sovereignty over their own land? I think you could see a really big fight if that happens. There's already Border Patrol all over that reservation, and they hate it. They're always stopping people. So the thing about a border wall of the scale and size that Trump is talking about, to me, it's just a financial boondoggle, which is what border enforcement has been pretty much all along. They hire these big companies to build these walls. They pay them a bundle. There's a lot of other kind of border security going in. We're, you know, moving on to the age of digital security and drones and, you know, high-tech things. In fact, the Border Patrol itself has said, we don't really need more agents. This is before Trump. We don't really need more agents. We just need more of these gadgets. The walls really don't do the trick. They want sensors in the desert. You know, they're moving on to a different model. But Trump is coming in with this older model because it seems to be something that people can relate to, the idea of a wall. But again, as we discussed, you know, the costs of it. And here in Arizona, we have these very fragile public lands that we cherish, many of them along the border. their environmental costs to doing all this. They've already wrecked one of the few remaining rivers in Arizona with a wall that goes through it and causes flooding and other kinds of damage, endangered species. So, and you know, anytime I drive down to the border on my way back, I get stopped by the Border Patrol. There's a Border Patrol checkpoint, and they're all over southern Arizona, and I'm sure, you know, in Southern California and in Texas. You as an American citizen can be stopped at any time by the Border Patrol and asked to account for yourself. And I love it. When I wrote my first book, a Border Patrol agent told me, oh, there's an asterisk on the Constitution here along the border. So, I mean, that has been the case for a long time, but it's just looking like it's going to get a lot worse. But again, you know, I think you cannot avoid the financial implications of all this. Who are the big companies? You know, Boeing does a lot of work on the high-tech border security. All these people that are going to build the wall, the people that are going to build the new detention centers. You know, the day after Trump won, the stocks of the for private prison corporations shot up like 60%. Because, you know, border enforcement is really good for certain enterprises that have the ear of the government. So, yeah, I mean, we will see an increase in civil rights violations. There's a town in southern Arizona that's been fighting this for a long time, watching over the Border Patrol checkpoint, being harassed by the Border Patrol when they do it, some of them being dragged out of their cars for not answering the questions of the Border Patrol in a way that they Border Patrol wants. So there's a lot of tension already, and I think we'll see a lot more of that, you know, with this big increase coming up.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have time for just one more question in just a few minutes on this, but it's something I've wanted to ask you because you actually deal with this very powerfully in a lot of ways. We've been talking all this time about people living in a state of terror right now, a lot of people living in a state of terror, hunted down, separated from families and children, dumped across the border. What do people have, in your experience, what do people have waiting for them when they get dumped across the border? I thought you've written pretty powerfully about what actually happens then.
Yeah, well, it's pretty terrible. You know, the border town that I go to all the time is Nogales. That's about 60 miles south of Tucson, where I live. And you know, about 8 years ago, there were so many deportees being dumped into that town that the government came up with a couple of protocols. You know, they do greet them at the border. And by the way, they check very carefully to make sure they're Mexican citizens. And Trump is mistaken in believing that Mexico is going to accept people from other countries. As he has said, he is going to dump the other people there, but they're not going to take them. Anyway, they confirm that they're Mexican citizens, and they give them kind of documents, really, to entitle them to services in the town. There's a Catholic soup kitchen called the Comedor where people go. There are shelters, and the government will give them a half-price bus ticket if they want to go back to Veracruz or wherever they came from many years ago. But by and large, you have this large population of people who are disoriented. They're depressed. Often they don't have any ID with them. They've been picked up by Border Patrol, and sometimes their IDs are taken. They don't have any money. And many of them, if not the majority, their families are in Seattle or Virginia or Chicago. They don't think of home as being, you know, Chiapas or Oaxaca. They're there, and all they can think of is, how do I get back to my kids? How do I get back to my husband or my wife? It's a devastating thing to see how hard it is for those people, and these groups step in to try to help, and there's only so much they can do. A lot of them try to go back, and then they get caught. I met one woman who had tried 3 times to get back to her kids in Seattle. She had gone down to Mexico because of an illness in the family, and she was trying to get back, and she was distraught. She had little children up in Washington State. And she had tried 3 times to get over the border to get back to them, and she couldn't make it through. I don't know whatever happened to her. You know, these are real lives and real people, real families and real children that have lost their parents. You know, that's us doing that to them.
Mm-hmm. All right, Margaret, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Really tough topics.
Yeah, and we'll be back in touch. I want to have you back on again. All right?
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, Margaret, take care now.
All right.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Margaret Regan, writer, and we've been talking about the roundups and deportations of immigrants and the impact that Trump's rule changes are having and are threatening to have. And Margaret's a longtime journalist in Tucson, Arizona, and the author of Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. Now I want to take a couple minutes for myself to talk to you about. I read something this morning that I really want to pass on, all right? It's something I think is important. Now, again, I'm reading to you something that somebody else has actually said, and this is important enough to repeat again. These attacks, especially the attack on sanctuary jurisdictions, is not just some scattershot terrible thing. It is a terrible thing, but it is a key piece of the whole vision and mission of the Trump-Pence fascist regime. Demonization, persecution, and driving immigrants out of the U.S., at least ones who don't fit into their definition of white, and is central and essential to their hellish agenda to make America white again. For them, there is no turning back in the war on immigrants. They have whipped up mobs of people who believe they are entitled to going back, way back, to a nightmarish era of U.S. history and worse. That requires the violent ethnic cleansing of America. What people have done so far in response to Trump's all-out war on immigrants has been very important and inspiring. The battle to defend immigrants and sanctuary jurisdictions is life and death in its own right, and there are even bigger stakes. Trump's threats against sanctuary jurisdictions take place in the context of and in service of the regime moving to tighten a death grip on the levers of state power. It is connected to moves to tear down other state, county, and city-based concessions like protection for LGBT rights, civil rights ordinances, and environmental protection rules. In response to moves to make California a sanctuary state, Trump threatened, "If we have to, we'll defund." And then he said, "California, in many ways, is out of control, as you know." All of this has the potential to become a flashpoint in society, eruptions of conflict that could prove pivotal to whether or not the Trump-Pence fascist regime can fully consolidate power. What we face right now is larger than a series of terrible attacks on different fronts. After all, in just the past 2 weeks, the Trump-Pence regime has launched attacks against a whole spectrum of people and issues. This is a package, an attempt through relentless moves, one after the other, to radically reorder society into fascism. If we fight these one at a time, there may be some victories here or there, but the overall trajectory is into horror. Think about it, sisters and brothers. This regime is not only bolting into place an openly white supremacist America in which those who are not white will have virtually no rights and many will be confined in prisons or camps, one way or another. This regime is also threatening other countries. After all, the perverted leader of the regime is known to have asked the CIA at briefings, "If we have nuclear weapons, why can't we use them?" The greatest danger before us right now is to underestimate the danger that this regime poses across the board, not only in the U.S., but to the entire world, and indeed to the fate of humanity and the environment. This leads to the second and even greater need, a movement that says no to the whole thing, that demands the immediate ouster of this vicious and extraordinarily dangerous fascist regime. And that's a statement I thought everybody should really spend some time thinking about. And along those lines, no, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. This is some of this. I'm going to read you some of the slogans that are being taken up by refusefascism.org, refuse fascism, okay? So it's no, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. No human being is illegal. No ban, no wall, no raids, no deportations. Drive ICE out of L.A. Drive out the Trump-Pence fascist regime. People, wake up. We got it. We got a whole hell of a lot of responsibility in the world today, so let's get down to it. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Well,
Right, right. That's Not in Our Name from Savage Rose. Just get that kicks me every time I hear it. And I hope it. I'm watching people in the other room. It's kicking them, too. Yeah, nobody's sitting still on that one, all right? In your head or on your body. Just the other day, I came upon a person who was writing and doing things that really grabbed my attention. Her name is Rachel Ida Buff, and she's a professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And she's been writing on the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. She's also got a new book coming out soon called Against the Deportation Terror, Organizing for Immigrant Rights in the 20th Century. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Sure, sure. It's good to talk with you. Well, let's jump into things right away, all right? I'm actually, as I'm saying that, I'm looking for what I did with all the... Oh, there it is. Okay, see, I've got a desk full of paper here, right? Okay. Your assessment of the situation facing immigrants today. Give people a picture of what's out there and the impact it's having on immigrants and their families. This is an extremely important thing, I think, in terms of people actually understanding this is a group of people who very often are kept in the shadows, either you know, the real shadows or, and increasingly so, the real shadows, but also the shadows of people's living on the edges of what people see, you know, and the people see them every day, but they know nothing about them. So give people an assessment of the situation facing immigrants today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good phrase. Thank you for saying that, living in the shadows. So I think what we have is people who are already marginalized because of being undocumented. And it's important to say that there are 12 million estimated undocumented people living in this country. They don't live en masse. Like, so most undocumented people live in households with people who are citizens and people who are legal permanent residents. So it's not like there's a clump of people in the shadows. It's that there are people whose lives are partially shadowed. So in the state where I live in Wisconsin, there's no legal driver's license for undocumented people. That came about in 2005 with the passage of the Real ID Act. So that means, and we don't have very good public transportation here, even in a city like Milwaukee where I live. So that means if you're driving to the work you can obtain as an undocumented person and you get stopped for a traffic seizure, that's a cause for fear in the best of times, even before the current regime. What we've seen in the past 4 weeks since the executive order about immigration is an upsurge of terror in these communities because there were a lot of deportations under Obama, but the general gist, and it wasn't always observed, was to try and deport people who were criminals or who had outstanding warrants. What we've seen now is almost the opposite, the criminalization of being undocumented. So what we've seen is an upending of everyday life. So if you are going about your everyday life, if you are dropping off your child at school, if you are headed to work, if you're on the bus, if you have to go to the courthouse, God forbid, for any particular reason, all of those places become spaces of terror. And we've seen deportation raids from hospitals, from schools, from all the places that constitute everyone's daily life. The other important thing that should be said is that in 2011, in the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, there was a so-called sensitive locations memo that said, you know, it's really not good for the Immigration Customs Enforcement agents to perpetrate raids in schools and hospitals and churches. This administration so far seems to be pursuing a very different direction, and that has a lot of consequences. I was recently visiting Western Michigan, and I was teaching a class, and I asked the students in the class, you know, what do you know about what's going on? And they talked about people they knew, undocumented people they knew, selling their cars and moving out of apartments and houses so that they would maximize the number of adults home in case one of them got deported and the kids came home from school without a parent there, about people preparing to leave to so-called self-deport, about people selling off their possessions. So I think what we have, and it's unclear yet whether the 3 to 4 million promised deportations will take place, what is already taking place is a level of terror in everyday life for many of the people in our communities.
Now, you've said that, and I think it's extremely important. You've also said that news of the assaults on immigrants, it's really important that actually people know that people actually get this out, that news of the assaults spread throughout the communities themselves, but then also beyond those communities. Let's talk about the importance of that.
Yeah, I want to say that I'm involved with a group of other immigration historians that we're doing a project called Documenting Deportation, because I can go into the historical reasons for this, but starting around 1954 with Operation Wetback, one accomplishment of the then Immigration Service, now the Department of Homeland Security, was to broadcast the fact that there are these illegal aliens, so-called, in our countries, while at the same time completely disappearing their names, so that in the press we just hear about this mass and they almost don't seem human, right? So you hear about illegal aliens detained and they sound like a bug or something, instead of, it's really important and it's because of 80 years of the immigrant rights movement, people saying, no, you know, this person has a name, this person is somebody to me. And so right now, the way things are going, only the government has the names of people in deportation proceedings. It's very difficult, for example, if somebody is detained, if you're a family member or friend is detained by the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, they're often taken, it's such a lucrative business, the business of detention, right? So you could be taken from Milwaukee County, detained in Illinois and wind up in detention in Texas, and your family would have very little ways of figuring out where you are. So it's a technique of power, and it's a technique of power for immigrant rights advocates to be able to track this information, you know, to be able to say this person was detained, and to, you know, it's been an achievement to say, you know, these are people, they have names. One thing that happens in my community is every the first Thursday of every month, the New Sanctuary Movement has a vigil in front of the Immigration Customs Enforcement Detention Center in town, and they read the names of the people in deportation. And it's really powerful. It's, you know, even before the current administration, it would be a really long list. And it's really powerful to hear the names, because otherwise, I always ask audience, how many people do you know? The names of how many people do you know who have been deported? And except for Latinos, people don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, other migrants, immigrants. If you're not in an immigrant community, you tend not to know the names of anybody, so they don't seem like people to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Rachel Ida Buff, Professor of History and Comparative Ethnic Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and we're talking about the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. You've been deeply involved in the sanctuary movement. Tell people what that is.
The sanctuary movement, the current incarnation of it, looks back to the 1980s when mostly religious communities gave sanctuary. And this is an older tradition, right, that the church is a safe space. It goes back to the Bible. It goes back to the Middle Ages, that churches and temples and mosques are safe spaces and they can shelter somebody from being apprehended. So that happened during the dirty wars in Central America, which the U.S. was deeply involved in militarily and in shipping aid through military advisors and through training people at the School of the Americas. And it generated waves of migrants, right, because they were fleeing terror that we had sponsored in their countries. This is really important. So when we have Honduran children walking to our borders and they seem to just turn up here, they're fleeing terror that the United States created in their region. That's really important. And I think people don't often connect the dots. Anyway, so that was a mostly religious-based movement in the 1980s. And in about 10, 15 years ago, there was a new sanctuary movement that said, you know, we're going to give aid to people who are in these situations, people, you know, from Central America, from Mexico, from Africa, from Poland, from Ireland, who are undocumented and who are in fear of or dealing with deportation. What we've seen with the current administration, and, you know, there's a whole complicated relationship and a really important relationship between the new sanctuary movement and movements like the DREAM, the DREAMers, the young people advocating against deportation and for legal status for themselves and their communities. But since the inauguration, we've seen a lot of communities really asking, you know, are we going, you know, really thinking, you know, is there, what churches are there that have kitchens and cots and bathrooms and how many people can they shelter? And I see this all over the country that people are asking, like, you know, can we shelter people? How can we shelter people? How can we prepare for this? And I also think a lot of communities, like traditionally this has been in foreign-born communities, but I think that one thing that's happening is, as we contend with what you were just talking about with the Muslim ban, as we contend with rising incidences of hate crimes against LGBT communities and communities of color and Jewish communities, like that, we have to think broadly about how can we have public security? What does security mean for all of us? Right? So I think that there's a lot of renewed thinking going into sanctuary as securing public safety for all of us. You know, what does it mean if we live in communities where a good portion of us are terrorized and afraid to go, literally afraid to go out, literally afraid to go about their day-to-day lives? And that's going to be more and more of us, right? How do we go about addressing that and creating a space of safety?
Mm-hmm. Now, you've argued that this, you know, and actually you've made the point very clearly and very powerfully that this sanctuary movement does exist in some tension with federal authorities and federal law.
Yes.
And are there reprisals? What are the kinds of reprisals that people should know about?
Well, there's a lot of political threats. You know, we're in a season of political bullying, right? So in Wisconsin and federally, there are these anti-sanctuary city bills that have been proposed. It's certainly something that's been promised by our current presidential administration. Sheriff Dave Clark, it's very interesting in Milwaukee because the county of Milwaukee, our county sheriff is Sheriff Dave Clark, who's very anti-immigrant, very anti-Black Lives Matter. He wears a cowboy hat and cowboy boots everywhere. And he claims that sanctuary cities are, quote, breeding grounds for crime because they're places that shelter undocumented people. And because, and this is an important grammar, because undocumented people, by virtue of being here, are considered by people like Dave Clark criminals. That's the only kind of criminals they are, it should be pointed out. He makes it sound like we're like talking about free space for rapists and murderers. That's not what anyone is talking about. So we have that, but our county in early February passed an anti-discrimination resolution that included instructing local police not to comply with federal immigration enforcement. So this sets up a pretty interesting tension because there are promised reprisals at the state level, at the federal level. And of course, we have this very anti-immigrant sheriff. But what I call popular morality, which is that most people do not want to see their neighbors dragged away from their children. Most people see, if they can see it, if they're allowed to see it. And one really important thing is that these have been made invisible, so we don't have to witness them. But when we witness them, they're appalling. And most people, you know, the churches that have granted sanctuary and have been involved in the sanctuary movement aren't radical churches. They often tend to be sort of liberal mainline Protestant churches or Catholic churches or Reformed Jewish temples or mosques, where people say, you know, this is a very basic moral issue of giving shelter to the stranger, right? It's not that radical of a position. So we're really in a place where, like we are with so many things in the current moment, where we have to say, you know, where are we going to stand in terms of basic human decency? And how are we going to have a politics that allows that in this regime that intends to brutalize people, that states its intent to brutalize people? And I don't think we really know. I mean, there's a constitutional issue here as well. Can the federal government force states, force campuses, force counties to comply? I don't think that's been litigated yet. And, as we've seen with the Muslim bans, there are constitutional reasons those don't work. I'm not sure a federal anti-sanctuary bill, a federal bill that mandates that local police departments have to sign 287G agreements and enforce immigration, I'm not sure that's constitutionally enforceable.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rachel, as unbelievable as it seems, we are going to have to wrap this up right now. So I wanted to... We'll have to have you back, and especially when your book comes out. When's it coming out?
I think it should be early fall, but I'll definitely let you know.
Yeah, definitely do. And we'll stay in touch in terms of the development of things, because I'm sure as hell, I'm confident that things are good with Trump and Pence and everything that's going on with this. This is a regime that actually is, it's a regime that has in its vision the entire sanctuary movement and all of the people who depend on that in terms of being able to stay free and alive. All right, so... We'll definitely be in touch.
So we have our work cut out for us, but I'll definitely send you a copy and we'll be in touch.
Great. All right, Rachel, take care now.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Bye now. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Rachel Ida Buff, professor of history and comparative ethnic studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, on the terror created in immigrant communities from weeks of ICE raids, the need for creating sanctuaries, and the need for collective resistance. And if you want to get involved, you can contact Refuse Fascism. Their website is refusefascism.org. You can reach them on Facebook, and their Twitter is @refusefascism. And if you want to send an email, their address is info@refusefascism.org. And their phone number is 917-407-1286. Once again, that's 917-407-1286. And if you go to the Refuse Fascism website, you can find a chapter in your area. And speaking of important websites with relevant and indispensable content in these times, there's a new piece out now on revcom.us. It's a new talk by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the talk is called The Problem, the Solution, and the Challenges Before Us. This is an important talk given by Avakian earlier this summer, and it's available as a downloadable text and also audio, so you can read and or listen to it yourselves. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank our guests, Margaret Regan, a longtime journalist in Tucson, Arizona, and the author of Detained and Deported Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire, and Rachel Ida Buff of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. You can find all of them on social media. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Kiana Williams. And I want to thank each and every one of you for listening. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
Somos ilegales.